Good day, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Bone Marrow Transplant Understanding and Coping with Chronic Graft versus Host Disease. At this time, all participants are on a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will be given at that time. If you need operator assistance, please press star then zero on your touchtone telephone. As a reminder, this conference is being recorded. I would now like to turn the conference over to your host, Ms. Tiffany Rowe. Ma'am, you may begin.
Welcome to the National Bone Marrow Transplant Link's telephone conference, Understanding and Coping with Chronic Graft versus Host Disease. This is Tiffany Rowe. We are very happy that you have joined us and hope that you find this program very informative. At the end of the program, there will be an opportunity for the audience to ask a few questions. The recording of this program will be made into a podcast, which will soon be available on our website at www.nbmtlink.org. It is now my pleasure to introduce Myra Jacobs, founding director of the NBMT Link. Myra?
Thank you, Tiffany. Welcome, everyone, to this invaluable program. I would like to thank our sponsors, the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society and the Meredith A. Cowden Foundation, and also extend our thank you to our three outstanding speakers who have very generously given of their time and their professional dedication to chronic graft-versus-host disease patients and families. Dr. Mary Flowers, Professor of Medicine, University of Washington, and Director of Long-Term Follow-Up at the Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center, and Sandra Mitchell, Research Scientist, Outcomes Research Branch, National Cancer Institute in Bethesda, Maryland, and Ellen Frank, PhD and BMT survivor who is coping with chronic graft versus host disease, and she's coming to us from Boston. And now I would like to introduce Dr. Flowers.
Thank you very much, Myra, and good afternoon, everyone, and good evening for others in the other part of the country. It is a pleasure for me to be part of this event, which I hope it will be helpful for all of you. I'll be talking to you first about the overall of chronic GVHD, what is the disease, what is the risk factors and treatment that are used or being under investigation, and also give you some monitoring information that I think it might be helpful. So chronic GVHD is actually one of the most common long-term complications after allogeneic transplant. About 50% of patients will develop this complication at 1 year, with 5 to 10% being diagnosed beyond 1 year. The median time for the diagnosis is about 5 to 6 months after transplant. It's a syndrome with different manifestations, therefore called pleomorphic syndrome, with multiple organ involvement, with inflammatory and also fibrotic, like scar type of the clinical manifestation. Chronic GVHD, however, has benefits. It has been associated with a decreased risk of recurrent malignancy compared to patients who never developed this complication. But chronic GVHD is a chronic illness with significant morbidity. It requires prolonged treatment with immunosuppression. It's associated with infections, not only because of its treatment, but because of the immune dysregulation associated with this problem. It can lead to disability, impair quality of life, and in severe cases can be associated with an increased risk of non-relapse mortality. Chronic GVHD is actually similar to some autoimmune disease, systemic lupus erythematosus, for instance, or Sjogren's syndrome, which is a Zika, which is a dryness that can happen in the eyes, in the mouth. It can also resemble something called scleroderma. It's not the same as systemic sclerosis, but has some similar features. It affects several organs, but the most common are the skin, the mouth, the eyes, and the liver and the GI tract. And in a comparative analysis, we looked at the similarities between chronic GVHD after bone marrow transplant and peripheral blood, and the distribution was quite similar. The risk factor, so who goes on to develop this complication? So So the increased incidence is among patients who receive an unrelated donor transplant. Those who receive a HLA mismatch compared to a HLA match donor, receiving a peripheral blood instead of a bone marrow, and the use of a female donor into a male recipient. Also, older age, either patient or donor associated with this complication, and a prior history of acute. There is only one factor that we know can decrease this complication, which is T cell depletion, which can be accomplished before infusing the cells, the graft, depleting the T cells, or by treating the patient with some antibodies that can deplete the cells in vivo. Unfortunately, when one does that, there is an increased risk of recurrent disease. So as I said before, all chronic GVHD is not all bad, because it is the beneficial effect to fight the tumor. The assessment and monitoring of GVHD is important, and it can be done not only to detect early symptoms, but also to monitor during the therapy and after stopping the treatment, because about 40% of the patient after discontinuation of immunosuppression may have exacerbation of the disease 1 year after stopping the immunosuppression. In addition to the clinical evaluation, recording severity and extent of the manifestation is important. And we find also that the digital photograph of the skin and the joint can be quite valuable to assess response over time. We find quite often that our patients and even our physicians as well sometimes think the patient is getting worse or better. And when we compare with the digital photos, then we can find that that assessment was not as accurate as the photographs can help. Chronic monitoring, we have several slides that we put it together that will be available to you in the website in 2 weeks from now that you can review at your leisure. And one of the chronic GVHD monitor calendar includes, for instance, a pulmonary function test. Because even if a patient is asymptomatic, no symptoms, we can detect some early decrease in lung volumes that can be quite beneficial to be recognized early on so that treatment intervention in clinical trials can be used to prevent the devastating manifestation of GVHD when it's severe and when it affects the lungs. Also, GYN, gynecologic evaluation for a woman can be important. And although most of the gynecologists are not familiar with chronic GVHD, there is a manifestation of GVHD that is completely identical to that we call lichen planus, which is a disease that many gynecology deals with outside the transplant setting. Therefore, follow-up via gynecologic can be of helpful, even if they don't have the expertise in GVHD. So there is several other slides in my presentation that will tell you about some of this monitoring, including, for instance, physical therapy, including DEXA scan, which is to assess the bone density, because most of the treatment we use for GVHD can cause bone loss. Also, other importance of monitoring high cholesterol, because many of the immunosuppression we use can also cause high cholesterol that can add to complications post-transplantation. The clinical evaluation, one of the most important pieces, is actually to examine the skin. And the skin can be examined by not just looking at, but touching and seeing if there is thickening of the skin, which can be detected earlier than when it can lead to more severe complications. There are 10 chronic GVHD specific questions that we put together that it will be available in the website that you can look at them later and to use to help you when you see your doctor to bring those up to them. Another important information that I think regarding monitoring of GVHD is to do a very four basic movement to assess the range of motion, which is also shown in a picture showing extension of the shoulders, extending the elbows, putting the hands together like a Buddha prayer position, and the extension of the ankles. One of the most common areas of presenting sclerosis, which is the more severe form of GVHD of the skin, affects the forearms and can be detected early on by kind of those positions that can detect some limitations. Also, in the oral cavity, we have set it up five or eight pictures that you can see what areas to look for the mouth and what should we be looking for. Is there a lacy, patchy type of changes? Is there some more beefy red erythema? Is there some ulcers? We'd like to detect things when it's earlier than when it's more advanced. So if we look at it, what's the incidence of the manifestation of GVHD that it's associated with more morbidity? And morbidity means more severity. And those are the ones that affect the lungs, that affects the skin in the sclerosis, that can affect the range of motion and decrease the ability of patients to open a jar, to put the sweaters over the head, to have some ulcers because the skin becomes so tight that the circulation is impaired. But also some esophageal strictures, which are narrowing of the tube between the mouth and the stomach. So when you eat, it can get stuck, and that can be a manifestation of GVHD. The other severe manifestation is a severe ocular dryness. And those four manifestations, can occur between 5 to 20% of patients with chronic GVHD. One of the problems of this syndrome is that the pathogenesis, what it causes, remains elusive. One of the models thinks that the GVHD is caused because donor alloreactive cells proliferate and attack the body. And the model to indicate that can be abrogated is by T regulatory cells, which is another type of T cells in our immune system that can suppress those alloreactivity cells and give tolerance. And in GVHD, what we have found is that these important cells that maintain surveillance in the body is decreased in chronic GVHD. And some of the treatment we use can either further impair those cells to come up. So what is the treatment of GVHD? Its primary therapy is with systemic glucocorticoid. High dose prednisone is bad because it's associated with increased risk of serious infections, all the severe comorbidity. Unfortunately, glucocorticoids fails to control GVHD in 40 to 60% of the patients. And the indication for secondary therapy is written there that I'm not going to pass at this time for the sake of time. But there are many secondary therapies for GVHD. Over 25 therapies have been reported or has been tested or are under investigations right now. In blue are the therapies that it's been under investigation or recently reported to have some effect on some types of GVHD. The principle of treatment relies on if it is a T cell, B cell, T regulatory cell involvement, or other mechanisms such as antibodies that can increase the production of fibrosis. And it depends on what is the pathogenesis, different therapies are used. The main traditional one is with immunosuppressive, which targets T cells. B cells is the use of Rituxan. It's an antibody against B cell. In the T regulatory cells involvement, the two therapies that has been shown to have some effect in allowing these T regulatory cells to come up is the ECP, which is extracorporeal photopheresis, and sirolimus. Another medication that has been now under investigation and has been reported is tyrosine kinase, which is Gleevec, imatinib, nalatinib, which is medications actually used for treating a certain type of cancer, such as CML. But in the end, it's the risk versus the benefits consideration that makes one to choose what therapy to use, when to continue, when to stop. It's the balance between the infections versus GVHD and balancing the graft versus leukemic effect versus the severity of GVHD. So to conclude, I could say that the importance of balancing risk versus benefits is the main key, but I would like to remind all of you here that the aim to achieve an alternate day regimen of prednisone at all possible is crucial, because we have found that even higher dose of steroids every other day is associated with so much less toxicity than the low dose of 5 milligrams daily. Also, we have found that inadequate treatment with prednisone, many people who hate the side effects of this therapy sometimes get pulses of steroids and in the end get to require more steroids in the long run due to the progression to a more severe forms of GVHD. I will pass it on and remind you that participation in clinical trials often are the best choice on the best choice. And I have been dealing with management of chronic GVHD now for over 30 years. And I can tell you, if I would have chronic GVHD, I would participate in clinical trials, because right now what we have are not enough. On the investigation therapy, there are several, and I will have you to look at the website for that. And lastly, I would like to say that some symptoms are sequela and will not improve with more immunosuppression treatment. Chronic GVHD is associated with an increased risk of secondary cancers. Thus, the importance to have health maintenance, including cancer screening, which has those slides in the website. And moreover, long-term survival also have increased risk of cardiovascular events. Thus, the importance to not add the other risk factors that it's associated with heart problems or strokes. So in conclusion, chronic GVHD is a chronic illness. It takes time to manage. In some damages may be reversible. Early intervention and compliance are important to prevent serious outcomes. Ancillary care are critical to decrease treatment-related toxicity and improve quality of life, and clinical trials are necessary for advance to occur in the field. Some website resources are in the website that I will not show you now. And I now have the pleasure to introduce our next speaker, which is Dr. Sandra Mitchell, who is a research scientist with the Outcomes Research Branch at the National Institute of Cancer and a nurse practitioner with the Chronic GVHD Clinic and Study Group. Sandy?
Thank you so much, Mary, and good evening and good afternoon to all of our attendees at this teleconference, and thank you to BMT Link for arranging for this wonderful opportunity for us to come together. I will also make a few remarks, and then after some additional remarks by Dr. Alan Frank, we'll be looking forward to your questions. Remarks that I will make will focus on options that you can consider to manage symptoms and maintain and improve health and well-being while living with chronic graft-versus-host disease. And as Dr. Flowers has, we've distributed to you some slides, and each slide includes some additional resources which you may want to review after the teleconference. I'm going to talk about some of the common GVHD-related symptoms and options for managing those symptoms, as well as some of the symptoms that are also very common as people are coping with graft-versus-host disease, including fatigue, sleep disturbances, malnutrition, inactivity, and problems with sexuality and intimacy. In terms of chronic GVHD-related symptoms in the skin and soft tissues, as Dr. Flowers has mentioned, these can include skin rash, thickening, and tightening. And immunosuppressive therapy is the cornerstone of management of this and really all GVHD manifestations. There are a number of new therapies emerging, including imatinib mesylate, and as Dr. Flowers said, clinical trials represent an excellent opportunity to receive this treatment under the careful supervision of a specialized team. Other options to treat skin and soft tissue symptoms include ECP and something called PUVA, as well as topical immunosuppressants, topical steroids, topical tacrolimus. It's important to keep the skin well lubricated because chronic GVHD causes excessive skin dryness. And it's also important to avoid sun exposure because this sun exposure can cause graft-versus-host disease to flare. For oral GVHD, we have a number also of topical immunosuppressive mouth rinses and ointments. Saliva substitutes are available, and even PUVA directed to the oral cavity can be valuable. It's very important, though, that people pursue routine dental prophylaxis, in other words, cleaning, and consider fluoride applications and mouth rinses to preserve oral health. Ocular or eye symptoms of chronic GVHD are extremely common, and they're among the most distressing symptoms that people experience. It's very important, whether you have symptoms of IGVHD or not, that you pursue an annual ophthalmic or eye doctor evaluation every year for at least the first 5 years after a transplant. This examination will allow the team to determine if you have any GVHD-related changes and if you have worsening eye dryness. In that case, preservative-free artificial tears can be helpful, and if there is evidence of inflammatory reaction within the eye, topical immunosuppressive agents, steroid eye drops, and cyclosporine eye drops can be very helpful. We can also conduct a temporary and then permanent blocking of the tear ducts, and that helps to preserve more moisture in the eye environment. And then we have a couple of other very exciting, fairly new options, and these are scleral lenses and autologous serum eye drops. And so ocular GVHD is one of the areas where we're beginning to make some inroads to improving symptoms and quality of life. Relative to lung graft versus host disease, it's also important not to rely on symptoms to determine that lung function is changing. Symptoms may be one of the later things that are noted, and subtle changes in pulmonary function can be detected with pulmonary function studies at regular intervals. It's also important to prevent infections of the lung, and at this time of year, it's appropriate for us to remind everyone that you should talk with your team about getting an annual flu shot. It's important that you report immediately any pulmonary symptoms that you have, such as shortness of breath, wheezing, cough, or difficulty breathing. It's also important not to smoke, or if you do smoke, to try to quit smoking. If you have lung graft versus host disease, treatment in a clinical trial represents an excellent option. And here again, inhaled or topical steroids and medications that relax the muscles in the lungs can be valuable. Also, emerging evidence shows that montelukast or Singulair can be valuable, as can treatment with the immunomodulatory antibiotic azithromycin. Vulvovaginal graft versus host disease is another common concern, and as Dr. Flowers mentioned, pursuing gynecologic evaluation is very important. Topical steroids and topical cyclosporine or tacrolimus ointment can be helpful in relieving symptoms, and consideration of the risk-benefit ratio for low-dose vaginal estrogen should be a consideration in discussions with the healthcare team. We recommend that women use lubrication during sexual intercourse, and that even during a period of time where they are not sexually active, that they use vaginal dilators to reduce webbing or narrowing of the vagina. And lastly, sexual counseling can also be very helpful. Many patients report muscle pain, cramping, and joint pain and restrictions. And again, these are all symptoms that may reflect chronic graft versus host disease. Physical therapy for stretching and strengthening is absolutely critical, and we can't underscore enough the importance of a regular routine of physical therapy. Other things that may be helpful for cramping and muscle pain, including application of heat, acupuncture, magnesium supplements, and muscle relaxants. Many patients report peripheral neuropathy, and this is an inflammation, injury, or deterioration of the peripheral nerves that results in a pain sensation that is like numbness, coldness, tingling, aching, pins and needles, burning, shooting, cramping, or clumsiness. It may occur as a side effect of cancer treatment, and many other common post-transplant causes can help to, unfortunately, make this worse. We have a number of very effective medications, though, to treat this, including Neurontin and antidepressant medications. So it's very important to discuss this kind of symptom experience with your clinical team. And this is another area where referral to physical therapy for muscle strengthening and exercises to improve balance are essential. Many, many patients in the post-transplant period experience fatigue, and this can be a very frustrating reminder of all that you've been through and with what you're coping with now. Fatigue after transplant can last for months or even for years, and it can be physically and emotionally draining for the individual and for their family. General weakness of fatigue may be accompanied by a limb heaviness or a reduced ability to concentrate, a sense of sleeplessness, or irritability. So if you are experiencing this type of extreme tiredness, your first step is to begin by speaking to your nurse or doctor about it. A low blood count, sleep disturbances, stress, depression, infection, and medication side effects can all contribute to fatigue, and your provider will need to sort all of this out for your individual circumstance. There are a number of simple tests that your healthcare provider can check to help eliminate some immediately treatable causes of fatigue. And then for your own self-management of fatigue, it's important to develop an approach to pacing yourself throughout the day and to pursue a moderate amount of exercise. Exercise is one of the interventions that has been consistently shown, paradoxically, to improve fatigue, particularly in long-term survivors of stem cell transplant. Sleep is also crucial, as is education. If you learn more about fatigue and your family learns more about fatigue, it seems easier and more possible for us to solve and address this problem together. One of the major factors that causes fatigue are difficulty sleeping. And difficulty sleeping, added to the stress to mind and body of undergoing a transplant and experiencing chronic GVHD, typically these experiences don't make existing sleep problems any better. It's very important to talk with your team about sleep problems, and particularly to talk with them if you think you may have signs and symptoms of a sleep disorder. This experience with sleep is something that we now have some good strategies to try to help people manage. And in fact, it is not best managed with a sleeping pill, but rather with something called cognitive behavioral intervention for insomnia. And I say to people, that's a long way of saying a whole program of things that basically our mothers and fathers told us to do. Things like going to bed only when sleepy, avoiding daytime napping, having a regular sleep schedule, and using the bed and bedroom for sleep and sex only, but no eating, TV watching, planning, problem solving while in bed. Cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia is much broader than what I have time to discuss tonight. We could spend a whole hour on this topic alone, but I've given you some websites that do a very nice job of walking you through the issues to consider in improving what we call your sleep hygiene or sleep health. And the last couple of things I'll touch on relate to sexuality and intimacy. And for some people, sex may be the last thing on their mind as they manage the challenges of a stem cell transplant. But as time goes on, many people do want to get back to a normal life, and that includes resuming a sexual intimacy with their partners. But a sexual side effects of prior treatment in GVHD can make this somewhat difficult. It's important to know two things. One is that it may take time for you to regain your sexual function after cancer treatment, but also know that if you had a positive and satisfying sex life before cancer, you will be able to resume that after your treatment. I've highlighted for you some of the things to consider relative to side effects, sexual side effects that men experience and those that women experience, and also given you some resources for this. Stress management is also key, and we've provided you in the slides some suggestions about ways to reduce stress and some websites and resources that may be helpful for you, including support groups, online support groups, telephone support groups, and counseling at local community centers or at schools. The last thing I'll touch upon is exercise, and exercise is crucial for every human being, but it's very, very important after a stem cell transplant and as you're coping with chronic GVHD. Exercise can increase range of motion and mobility, it can make you stronger, it can decrease stress, and it can very much lessen fatigue. But we all, I think, experience how hard it is to start and maintain an exercise program. We've given you some suggestions of things to consider and places where you can go to join exercise programs, particularly joining with others, sometimes can be very motivational for us. And the very last thing I'll touch on is nutrition. Dr. Flowers mentioned how chronic graft-versus-host disease can increase our caloric needs, and so it's very important to eat well-balanced meals and keep up sufficient protein intake. But this can be very difficult if your appetite is low or if you have chronic GVHD involving the mouth or involving the esophagus, the swallowing tube that goes from the mouth to the stomach. It can also be difficult to keep up a good diet if you have problems with malabsorption. So we've given you some suggestions to consider and some resources and websites that you can visit. And we would be glad to address some questions on this topic if indeed you have such questions once we move to the question period. So at this time, I'm pleased to turn the podium over to Dr. Alan Frank, who will conclude this portion of the teleconference before we open up the lines for audience questions. Dr. Frank was a senior executive and researcher in biotechnology, and she is a long-term transplant survivor who has battled chronic GVHD in many forms. She will share more about her journey in her remarks, but I'm confident that you will feel inspired and validated on your journey by her insights, courage, and resilience. And Dr. Frank.
Thank you so very much. And good evening, everyone. It is such a pleasure for me to be here tonight, and I thank the Link for putting this program together. So many of us are scattered all throughout the United States, and it's not often that we get to share our insights and experiences with each other. So I am 7 years post-transplant for my successful treatment of chronic lymphocytic leukemia, or CLL. And this evening I'd like to speak with you just about living and what it means to us to live post-transplant and with chronic graft-versus-host disease, and from my patient point of view. I'm going to speak to you from a point of lessons learned over the past 10 years or so going through treatment for this disease and now coping with chronic graft-versus-host disease. And one of the things I want to mention is first and foremost that you are not a hypochondriac, really. Sometimes I think we can feel like we have all of these problems that may be small or medium or large, and there seems to be so many things that we've heard already that can be occurring in the symptoms of chronic graft-versus-host disease that we can just think that we're just being hypochondriacs. And you are not. These things are happening, and you need to pay attention and, of course, talk to your healthcare team about it. Other lessons learned that I have found to be super important, and one is that I had maintained a relationship with my bone marrow transplant doctor and nurse practitioner over all these years. And I've allowed and, with his permission, used my physician as my first point of contact for when anything goes wrong. And so therefore, I'm letting the transplant doctor be the triage and decide whether I just have something normal going on that everybody else gets, amazingly enough, or whether or not this is another aspect of graft-versus-host disease. It's important for us to not let ourselves get into trouble, and by that I mean our own self-diagnosis. And we all do this, particularly over time. And we think, oh, this is nothing, you know, in a couple of days it'll be fine, I'll just wait and see. Well, with chronic graft-versus-host disease, I don't think we really have the luxury of doing that, because often there's a case where things can escalate quickly into more serious consequences, and if we had acted earlier, we would have been far better off. So we have to say no self-diagnosis, call your doctor first. Let the doctor make the determination whether or not you need to see a transplant physician or your regular doctor. Now, it may not be so easy depending where you are and where you are in location reference to your transplant center. Some people are quite far away, and some centers are more difficult to create long-term relationships with. And this is a part where I think we as patients have to assert ourselves. We have to be able to say, look, I need long-term support and care. I do it through email or text or phone calls, but we have a lot of mechanisms from which we can communicate with our physicians and our medical team without interrupting their day, so to speak, but still having them work closely with our local physicians, if at all possible. I actually went to a primary care physician here in Boston on the recommendation of my transplant doctor. She looked at all the drugs I was on and said, I have no idea what these are. And that was my first talk point to say thank you very much, and I left because I realized she wouldn't understand the side effects, the dosing issues, the interplay between some of these drugs, and, of course, the relation to some of the complications that we had. And this was my point to convince my transplant physician that he needed to stay in charge of my health care. So it's the rare primary care doc that understands graft versus host disease, its diagnosis and its treatments, and especially the drug regimen you are on. Now, it doesn't mean that some of our docs won't work at it and work with your transplant doc and learn about it, and that would be an optimum combination if it's achievable. But for this to be done, there's no way around it except for you advocating for yourself. And this is one thing we just always have to do in life. So our transplant care team is really a large group of people, potentially. There is the dentist, and I know that was mentioned by Dr. Flowers, but this is very, very important that you go see the dentist every 6 months post-transplant. I myself am going through a series of reconstruction of my teeth, having not followed that advice, and now I have cracked teeth and lots of problems with cavity due to the lack of saliva in my mouth and my dry mouth problem. So some of us didn't like the dentist before we had cancer, and we certainly don't like them anymore afterwards, but it is crucially important to see the dentist. Your annual visit with your primary care doc, you still need to do that. You still need to get your blood tests done annually, flu vaccines if that's appropriate, and just regular ongoing health care. The oncologist and your hematologist, again, I like to see that person in the center of the circle of my team as someone who is constantly informed from every doctor I see what's going on with me. You may need to see a gastrointestinal specialist, certainly. Diarrhea and other issues are on and off and constant with some of us, certainly for myself. And other issues do arise over time. I think as someone who's 7 years post-transplant, some of the long-term effects of the combinations of drugs that I'm taking are still to be known. And some of it is being discovered as we go along. The good news is that many of us now are living lives post-transplant at a much higher rate than ever before, and we're living for a long time. And so now we're able to see some of the longer-term complications. Pancreatitis was an issue for me recently, and I did not take that seriously enough and got myself into big trouble. So lessons learned. Your skin, pay attention. Especially men, I think you're not necessarily accustomed to putting cream on your bodies after every shower and really moisturizing your arms and your legs and your feet, but nothing could be more important. First of all, it feels good. It'll make you look younger, so that's a good thing. And secondly, it really does help keep your skin as healthy as possible. Seeing your OB-GYN every year, ladies, we're accustomed to doing that most of the time anyhow, but you need to keep up with that, especially if you have any vaginal complications. As we heard tonight, it's very encouraging that there are some treatments that are very helpful and which can really make our lives more comfortable. Don't forget your cardiovascular checkups, especially those of you who have had radiation. There are long-term complications. Plus, we're actually getting older, so even though things may occur that have nothing to do with our graft-versus-host disease, it still means we have to take care of our bodies in every way. And that's where your annual checkup will come in as well. I have to tell you, I recently went for an exam, and I have many skin pigmentation issues on my skin as a result of GVHD. So I have these dark brown spots all over my hands, my face, my legs. And I noticed that one of my spots was acting differently than the rest of the spots. It was raised. I could feel it. It was bothering me. So right away, of course, I call my doctor and I ask him what it is. And he gives me some complicated phrase, which I'm sure that one of our doctors here would know what he did, but it ends up being an age spot. So I've lived long enough to get my very first age spot, and, of course, was devastated at the news. But it's important to have these things checked out because we don't know. And then the last part of the team that I think is actually important is psychological support. There's no question that in any chronic disease, this long-term complication is very, very wearing on us. So here we are, a group of people who have faced the cancer diagnosis, who have often faced failing many chemotherapy treatments, and now we were left with only choice of our transplant. We've successfully accomplished the transplant, and here we are with another chronic disease. That's kind of a lot of punches in a row for us to take, and I can't emphasize enough that getting support, and especially just for you, support of a third party who is really only interested in you, who you can really be honest with and talk about your concerns and your dreams and your hopes and your issues, can only do good in terms of helping you. I'd like to add to these lessons then that I've learned that I've worked with many people and gotten to know so many of us who have this disease. And I have learned that every person's experience is unique. My skin problem is my skin problem, and it's often quite different than someone else's skin problem. And so I hesitate, as with all of us, to generalize to all other graft-versus-host disease patients and to remember that many of the ways our symptoms materialize are unique to our bodies, to our transplant, as well as to the disease that we had in the first place. So this is why we need to search for experts to help us, experts like we have on tonight's call, and to make sure that if you don't get an answer when you see a physician that makes sense to you, you've got to move on. It just doesn't feel right what they're telling you. I recently actually had to change my entire GI team at a major hospital in Boston, one of the top five in the country, because I did not feel I was getting the right care and I was not getting the right diagnosis. And at the end of the day, I was right. So if you just don't feel well, if it just doesn't feel right what you're hearing, trust your instincts. Find people who are willing to listen and pay attention to what you have and not drop you into some common category right away and get a second opinion. This can mean calling friends, calling back your transplant center, calling references like the link and other materials that you'll see on our website to help you find the right physician to listen to what's going on. But the good news is that so far it seems that no matter what I've come up with, there seems to be an answer for everything that has happened so far. Over time, so I'm 7 years post-transplant, and many of you are a few years post-transplant, I believe we'll often find that our support systems do change. During the immediacy of the crisis, we have lots of people helping us, helping our children, helping our families, giving us food, driving the kids places, and it's fantastic. But after 4 or 5 years, people can say, well, look, you're through transplants. It's years and you're cured, and, boy, you look great. And you should be grateful to be alive. What seems to be the problem? And we must remember, very few people are going to know about GVHD. There are not that many of us around, and we're certainly not clustered together. We're scattered throughout the country. And it's something that is just starting to get more and more attention, but again, it's a very small number of us. So I don't think it's fair necessarily to expect that our friends and families are going to really get it. And that's why the discussion, like on fatigue this evening, about the more information we have, the more we can share with our friends and families, the better they'll be at helping to support us. Because as we live on now, and hopefully cancer-free, and dealing with the issues of GVHD, we're still looking for a good quality of life, a day where we have purpose each day, and people we love to be with, and things we like to do. And this is what we need to reestablish. And the rules could be quite different now post-transplant than they were pre-transplant. Support groups are vital. Some of us, like myself, can be kind of stubborn and think we know everything, but we'll find very quickly that when you participate in a support group on the phone or however, that it's great to hear people talk about things. Sometimes it's just reassuring to know you're not the only one, and also it's helpful to hear other points of view on different treatment approaches and ideas that people have used successfully. So finally, I'd like to say that after all of that is done and all that we have gone through, that you have to be kind to yourself. You really do. It is a new road that each one of us travels. It's an unknown road with unknown pitfalls, but also unknown beautiful things. And we have to be kind and give ourselves a break. Cut yourself some slack. You may not do everything the same as you used to, and that's quite all right. And reach out, because we are here, fellow patients, we are here, and we can be connected through the link and other means, and I think nothing is more reassuring than speaking with someone else and a group of people who have a true understanding of what it means when you're immunosuppressed or you have chronic diarrhea and how these things can impact your life. This is an endurance run, that's for sure. This is a long-term process. It's not a sprint. It's not over with in a minute. Some people, by the way, go back to full lives and do extraordinarily well. A couple people, smaller percentage by far, but like myself, continue with chronic graft-versus-host disease out into the longer-term years. But at the end of the day, these are things that we learn to handle. Just like we handled our cancer, and we learn new things about ourselves at every point. So you're okay, I'm okay, we're going to do well with this, and we're going to continue to be leaders in our field and learning about graft-versus-host disease as well. So I thank you for your attention, and I wish all of you to be well. Thank you. And now I think we turn to our question and answer period.
Thank you very much, Dr. Flowers and Dr. Sandy Mitchell and Ellen Frank, for your presentations. Now I would like to ask our operator to give us the instructions for the Q&A portion of our program.
Ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question at this time, please press star then one on your touchtone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, please press the pound key. Once again, if you have a question at this time, please press star, then one.
As we wait for a question, I would like to ask our presenters. I have a question here. Somebody had asked the question, if I'm interested to find out more about clinical trials, where should they go to find that information?
In one of my slides, there is some web resource that does provide that website. It's very easy. It's www.clinicaltrials.gov. And when they go to that website, there is a place where they can just put the chronic GVHD and all the trials that it's currently open or closed or has been used, it's all there.
Our first question on the phone comes from Elise Fine.
Hi. First off, I would like to thank the panel. It was very informative, especially Ellen Frank. You're very inspirational and appreciate your insights. I'm the caregiver of an 18-month transplant survivor, and he, because of the transplant, had to have cataract surgery, and after the cataract surgery, it appears, although the ophthalmologist differs with the bone marrow transplant team, the ophthalmologist does not believe it's graft versus host, and the bone marrow transplant team does. So he's been on the preservative-free tears, and also he has started a regimen of Restasis. My question is, after how long should we give the Restasis and the tears a chance before finding more out about the auto tears, because he's extremely uncomfortable and he needs cataract surgery on the other eye, which has been now postponed. It should have been done back in June, and it has now been postponed for about 6 months.
Thank you. This sounds like a question for Dr. Flowers.
Yeah, so your question is to know the duration of the artificial, the topical therapy with Restasis and also with the lubricant in the eyes, if I understood correctly. Usually the dry eyes caused by GVHD, unfortunately, is something that it's chronic. That does not preclude the treatment for the cataracts. They are different problems. Usually, however, the ophthalmology is concerned if the GVHD is well controlled, because the dryness can also lead to superimposed infection, and of course, infections of the eyes could complicate the cataract surgery. There is a web. There will be in the website in 2 weeks a handout that has other information about the resource that I would be. You know, you should visit those. Those are very informative.
And our next question is from William Sonak.
I'm 2.5 years post transplant. Diagnosed with AML, donor match. Unfortunately, I relapsed. Prior to relapsing, I conducted GVH. I'm currently in stage 2. I've had GVH off and on since first getting it. I'm being treated with dexamethasone or solumedrol. And also, I decided not to have a second transplant. After getting back into remission, I've been treated with Vidaza treatments every 6 to 8 weeks on a mild regimen. Does the Vidaza have an effect on the GVH?
This sounds like another question for Dr. Flowers.
This is a very interesting question that you have. Some have nobody knows the answer. That's the easy answer for me to give to you. But there are some ideas that Vidaza may be increasing the graft versus leukemic effect, therefore theoretically could have a detrimental effect in GVHD. Having said that, however, we have patients that have GVHD treat on Vidaza that are doing okay. So I don't think that we really know the complete interaction between the drug and the GVHD versus not.
Thank you.
And our next question is from Erin Courtright.
Oh, hi. This is Erin Courtright. I'm an AML survivor, 27 months post-transplant. And doing well, other than I have chronic graft versus host disease of my joints. And I'm fine except when I have a flare, which I get like every 2 to 3 months because I get sick, you know, a cold, or I've even had the children's flu, etc. My question is for Dr. Flowers. Because when I have my flares, I've been treated with prednisone, and you said that you suggest for prednisone to have it every other day, even if it's only 5 milligrams. And my question to you is, because I am on it like every 3 months with a flare. Is this universally accepted? Because my doctors, I've been on it, like they might have me on 5 milligrams, then we taper down to 2.5. But I've pretty much been I'm usually on it every day.
It's not universal, and that's one of the things that we like to call the attention about it, is because, I mean, one of the things to think about steroids is that anyone who are treated with steroids for any other disorder, independent of GVHD, when we come off the steroids, one of the most frequent signs of the steroids is arthralgia, pain in the joint, it's fatigue, it's nausea. It is a reaction from the body that requires more steroids. So sometimes not necessarily means it's the GVHD coming back, but it is the withdrawal side effects of the medication. And when I talk about the every other day, is because once one goes to every other day, when one tapers it off, this type of withdrawal syndrome does not necessarily happen as frequent. But it is not universal except to go to a every other day basis. This has been, something that has been tried here for 3 decades and has worked, and we have learned through the process that every other day was easier to get off without the adrenal insufficiency and other side effects that we see patients experience when they go every day. So it's something to consider talking to your physician about, thinking about next time if you do need to have the GVHD. We always start on daily. We never start every other day.
Oh, you start daily, and then you take every
right,
day. Okay,
right.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Our next question is from Kate Arnold.
Hi, this is Kate Arnold. I'm from Chicago, Illinois. I am 16 months post-transplant, and very unusually, I developed GVHD in my lungs at day 40, which caused bronchiolitis obliterans, and I am down to 20% lung function and trying desperately to manage that. I'm only 40 and have 2 young children. And my question is, as I'm balancing my medications, I'm on tacrolimus and on prednisone, like, how can I tell the difference between what might be a flare-up from the bronchiolitis obliterans versus what might be graft versus host disease?
Yeah. So the thing about the bronchiolitis obliterans is that, someone who has significant lung loss are more susceptible when they developed any infection to have exacerbation of that symptoms, and then we don't know if it's an infection or it's because the GVHD is getting worse. You said you're 15 months out and that you've been diagnosed with BO, bronchiolitis obliterans, on 40 days post-transplant, which is quite early, and you already said that. The symptoms itself cannot distinguish GVHD versus other causes. We cannot make that difference. The only way that we try to decide what if the therapy needs to be changed is to rule out if we are dealing with infection, because that's the most common concomitant problem happening, so that it can guide us what we do with the other therapy. But there are clinical trials now with the BO, and I would suggest you to go into the clinicaltrial.org.
Okay, thank you. And then I actually have a second question, if you don't mind, that's related to the question regarding the prednisone every other day. As I'm trying to manage my medications and also, find the lowest possible dose, right now I'm on 10 milligrams of prednisone every day. And obviously I would discuss this with my medical team, but could it be possible that I could taper to 10 milligrams every other day
It's very hard to do that right away, especially if someone has been on daily for a year. So that it can be done, but it can be very difficult to accomplish that is short term. Usually they convert the drug gradually to 20 every other day, which is basically the same as 10 every day. But that cannot be accomplished in a month or 3 months. Sometimes it takes a year to do that.
Okay. Thank you very much. I really appreciate all the information that you provided this evening.
You're welcome.
And our next question is from Dorothy Waldron.
Hi, my name is Dorothy Waldron, and I'm from Boston, and I'm so appreciative of having this panel put together. And I am 6 years out of transplant, which I had for a transformation of CLL to diffuse B-cell lymphoma. Anyway, and I've had graft-versus-host disease basically since transplant. And my question is, being 6 years out, I had GVHD in my eyes like 3 or 4 months after transplant. And I had it under control with different types of artificial tears for 4 years. And then all of a sudden, that stopped working. And so my question is, and I've been on CellCept for about 4 years. And my question is, can you just have a flare-up of a chronic GVHD somewhere where you've had it under control for many years and suddenly it just flares up? And also, I've been on these medicines, these immunosuppressive medicines, for so long. I mean, I was on Prograf, I was on cyclosporin, and then I've been on CellCept. Can that cause cardiovascular issues? Because I have high blood pressure, which I never had before. I don't know whether that's because I'm just getting older, I'm almost 60, or, you know, could that be caused by the medication or even GVHD? Because I have a sclerodermis, skin GVHD in my thighs and in my arms, and I'm wondering whether that fibrotic process could affect blood vessels. So sort of a...
Okay, well, you cover a lot of things, and thank you for your question, and I'm very glad that you out there and that you don't have you CLL or B-cell lymphoma. The GVHD can have definitely exacerbation, can have flares, even when it's completely controlled. The most common cause for exacerbation of GVHD is another process that might be happening. We have frequently, our patient says that, you know, the infection, even if you don't have a clear infection, but you have a little sore throat or a little bit of viral illness or a gastroenteritis or a stressful situation has come, and that has been already shown, stress does decrease the imbalances of the immune system that may change the ratio of the cells that we needed to be up to control GVHD, it lower when it's not controlled. So when those things happen, you can have an exacerbation of GVHD because infection can increase cytokines, inflammatory response, and that creates a milieu that allows for the alloreactivity to happen. So it can happen. It does not mean that because it has an exacerbation, we needed to go back to much higher dose of immunosuppression, because as time goes by, some of the damage that I talked to you guys about, it, some of the damage is irreversible, and more immunosuppression is not going to make those things to go better. You can get better on your own because that imbalance of the regulation that goes up and down goes back again to another level by not doing anything in terms of the systemic immunosuppression. You asked the question about can the medications that I take can increase my risk for heart disease. What we know is that in any immunosuppression therapy, and this is also in solid organ transplant, that we are concerned that systemic immunosuppression can suppress the good cells that helps us to not develop other cancers. So we don't know what immunosuppression might be related to cancer or not, but every time you are suppressing the immune system, we're not suppressing only the things that are bad. We also suppress the things that are good. And we do not know yet how to suppress just the bad guys and leave the good guys in.
Mm.
And in terms of cardiovascular, because of the sclerosis, actually we have not yet found the sclerosis of Crohn's PhD is different than the systemic sclerosis, where heart problems is often a complication or a part of that syndrome. In GVHD, those events are very, very rare. Therefore, we do not believe it's the same disease.
Thank you. That's very helpful.
Our next question is from Denise Martin.
Hi. I'm 5.5 years post-transplant for myeloma, and I have a question, but I also wanted to speak to the person with the ocular problems. I have very, very severe GVHD in my eyes. And I've done all the tears and all the plugs and all the auto, where they make your own serum, all of that. The only thing that's helped is getting the scleral lenses. There's a Boston company somewhere. I don't remember the name of it. They're very, very, very expensive, about $8,000, but they are worth every penny because otherwise I couldn't function. My eyes were so severe. I couldn't drive. I couldn't see. I couldn't work. I couldn't do anything. And with the lenses, which actually hold sterile saline against your eyes all day long, I'm functioning really well. And I just wanted to put that out there. My question is about vaccinations. I have been on immunosuppressants and prednisone for the whole time, 5.5 years. I never quite seem to get off of them, and I have not had my vaccinations. And I was wondering, can you get your vaccinations while you're on immunosuppressants? Is that a possibility?
Yes. Well, I will let Sandy to talk to you more about the scleral lens thing, but in terms of the immunization, there is no contraindication whatsoever to receive immunization because you receive immunosuppression. Because all the vaccinations that we recommend for the post-transplant patients who are receiving an immunosuppression are dead virus or dead bacteria. So there is no harm in getting them. The only issue is to know, can a patient who are taking immunosuppression able to get the benefit of the immunization, could they mount the immune response for that vaccination? And the answer is yes. Not everyone do, but many of them will. Therefore, we do not exclude our patients who are in immunosuppression to receive the boost immunization.
Okay, thank you.
So just to respond to your comments about the scleral lenses, thank you so much for those observations, and we're so glad that your experiences have been so positive. The lenses that you referred to are called Boston scleral lenses. They're also called Jupiter lenses, as in the planet Jupiter. And they are expensive, but we are very lucky that now many, many, many insurance companies are recognizing that this is a therapy not only that qualitatively produces this kind of improvement, but actually there are many studies now documenting that for patients with GVHD, Sjogren's, and other disorders where the eyes become severely dry and ulcerated, that these lenses improve clinical outcomes and actually can be cost-saving over the long run for the insurance company. So it's very much worth pursuing it with your insurance company, and the people at Boston Sight, which is the company that and the team that prepares the Boston scleral lenses, will work with you to try to help get reimbursement from your insurance company.
There will be in the website some of the reports that has been that summarize the experience of this lens in Crohn's GVHD. It will be there. But I'm glad that you brought that up because, as Dr. Mitchell said in her presentation, one of the most disabled signs of GVHD can be only the eyes, and this is disabling people that cannot work, cannot do anything at home because the eyes are hurt so much. The lens are not for everybody, and the lens, although the Boston Foundation is the one that has developed this, the fitting of the lens now has several locations in the country that can fit the lens there, and then they can ship the lens from Boston.
Yes, I actually had mine at USC in California.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Next question is from Betty Lewis.
Yeah, actually, Betty's my caretaker, but my question is, I'm on 60 of prednisone, and because I have graft versus host of the lungs, similar to the other person, I got it months after transplant, about 8 months after transplant, I got graft versus host of the lungs, and I had to go on a very high dose of prednisone. They found that they had to keep me around 60 to keep my airways open and to keep me from basically failing. And they've got me on photopheresis with that, trying to reduce down my prednisone. And it almost seems like too much. I'm taking that with Enbrel and some other side of things. And the prednisone is basically eating my body away. And I'm wondering about alternatives to that, and what your thought is on photopheresis, because without photopheresis, I feel much healthier, even though it's not supposed to be draining that much. I have more energy, I'm able to exercise, and things feel more natural. And I'm also feeling as if I've kicked back quite a bit of the graft versus host, but we're not moving on the prednisone. So I was just looking to get some of your input on that.
Yeah, there has been some reports with ECP benefit in some patients with BO. That's why, you know, the idea about using that therapy is reasonable. The reason that we are not so specific about saying, yeah, this works, that worked better, or whatever, is because up to this point, there is no convincing evidence of studies that has been done in a way to address what is best for that particular manifestation at that time. Because most of the studies that has been done in chronic GVHD, because it's not a very frequent problem, thank you to not be, but it is such, it's very difficult to accrue enough patients with the same symptoms to be tested with different drugs in the end of the day to say which one worked and which one did not. But the ECP has been one of the therapies that people has used in hopes to decrease the dose of the prednisone to the lowest tolerated dose. So it's a trial and error. I think it's a good idea that they are using that on you.
Right, and as far as clinical trials, I've had a hard time finding clinical trials for graft versus host of the lungs, but you believe there are some out there that are definitely...
There is a trial right now about the use of metulocast, the singular, which probably you already have used.
I've been using that for about 6 months.
Yeah, so I don't think there is any other trial that I'm aware of using other drugs right now for BO. But it does not mean that today there isn't, tomorrow might be, because the field is growing quite fast. So I would, no matter what, I would look at that website every, 3 months or so, because new studies are coming up quite frequent. Right now, I am not aware that there is a clinical trial. Sandy, do you know? For BO other than the singular?
I don't. I'm going to look just while we're talking here, but unfortunately the singular trial that Dr. Flowers mentioned, it's being conducted actually here at the National Institutes of Health and also at Fred Hutchinson. Only people who have never received singular before are eligible. But I agree with Dr. Flowers. There's a lot of interest. Everyone realizes this is a very understudied complication, and I think there will be more trials in the future.
Yeah, there has been people who needed a lung transplant for BO. There's been about 7 patients that we are aware of that have been transplanted here for bone marrow or peripheral blood. We have, I mean, the longest survive we have here is 40 years. So we have a lot of people out there off immunosuppression, doing well. Some people still with GVHD, but no longer on immunosuppression, 17, 25 years out. So what I want to say is that sometimes lung transplant is necessary. But okay. those are, you know, it's more the end road type of thing. So the whole point here for anybody who has BO is to try to get the disease control with other means so that the lowest dose of steroids is used to decrease its long-term toxicity.
Thank you very much. Unfortunately, this is Myra again. Our time has run out. An hour and 15 minutes really went by fast. We recognize that everyone may have needs that go beyond the scope of a 1 hour and 15-minute program, and we wish that we could go on longer and longer. Hopefully next year, early next year, we will have another telephone conference. But do please contact us at 800-546-5268 if you have questions about this program or for further information about our other programs and publications, or do remember to visit our website at www.nbmtlink.org. You will find some very useful publications and a listing of other programs that we have throughout the year.
Myra, this is Sandy. I'm sorry, I just want to jump in again to say
sure.
that I do know of another trial at the NIH with the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute
Great.
That is using inhaled cyclosporin and studying that for bronchiolitis obliterans in both lung transplant patients but also stem cell transplant patients, and that study has just opened.
And it's the clinicaltrial.com?
It is at clinicaltrial.gov, but actually you don't initially see it under chronic graft-versus-host disease. You actually see it under bronchiolitis obliterans. So there's actually quite a few. If you go into bronchiolitis obliterans, you see quite a few trials that have been completed, and then a few other different ones that say that they are recruiting.
Thank you, Sandy. Thank you.
I'm
for
sorry
that.
To have interrupted you, though.
No, I think it's important. Now, we will soon be emailing you a program evaluation, which we would really appreciate your returning to us, as these evaluations are very important to us in developing future programs. And it is very helpful to see how this program was received. We hope you did get a lot out of it. And and we will be posting the recording of this teleconference on our website in a couple of weeks, which will include the handouts that the speakers have provided. So this concludes the telephone conference, and you may now disconnect and have a wonderful evening, and thank you all for joining us. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation in today's conference. This concludes the program. You may now disconnect. Everyone, have a wonderful day.